It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, candidates are down to the wire with just 6 days left until midterm elections. We'll talk last-minute strategy during our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer.
First, we're talking about a new report on jobs in the Wisconsin economy. Since 2000, low-wage jobs have grown faster than any other wage category in the Badger State. That growth accelerated in the year since 2010, when the state was recovering from the Great Recession.
Mark Levine is with us to break down this report and talk about what it says about Wisconsin's economy. He's a professor of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. He's the lead author of the report we're talking about. It's titled, Is Wisconsin Becoming a Low-Wage Economy? Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when we're talking low-wage jobs, what is the pay range here and what kind of jobs are we talking about?
Well, we define low-wage jobs as jobs paying under $12.50 an hour. Other studies will use different definitions. That's, I think, a reasonable, plausible one. It's a fairly low one. If you charted that out to an annual wage, it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $26,000 a year. And so we've got low-wage jobs under $12.50. We've got middle-wage jobs as $12.50 to $25, and then high-wage jobs at $25 an hour and above. And what we found is that since 2000, and particularly accelerating in the post-Great Recession 2010 to 2013 period, a really substantial kind of reweighting of the job structure, of the occupational structure in Wisconsin toward the low end, that we've seen a growth in jobs like fast food cooks and waiters and waitresses, food preparation workers, generally child care workers, all earning, in many cases, not only under $12.50 an hour, but under $10 an hour, which we break down in the study as very low-wage jobs. So those jobs have grown. And then what we've also found is that jobs that were sort of somewhat above that $12.50 threshold between low and middle-wage jobs, jobs that were paying, you know, between $12.50, $13.50 an hour, a goodly number of those jobs have dropped below $12.50 in their inflation-adjusted wages. Jobs that helpers for production workers, nursing assistants, landscaping and groundskeeping jobs, and so the loss of sort of middle-tier status for some of those jobs has augmented, if you will, the number of low-wage jobs. That, combined with the rapid growth of other low-wage jobs, has meant we're increasingly becoming a low-wage economy.
So a double whammy. We're losing some of those middle jobs, getting more of the low ones, and some of the jobs that used to be in that middle have slipped to the low end of the spectrum.
Precisely. Wow.
So you said this trend started in 2000, but what happened in the crash and the beginning of the Great Recession?
Well, the recession, of course, obliterated jobs in all wage categories. So if you look at the three tiers that we analyze in the study, wage loss occurred in all three categories, although the vast number of jobs vastly largest share of jobs that were lost in the Great Recession were in the middle tier category. Over 90% of the jobs that were lost came from that category. So I think, you know, the shaking out that occurred during the recession obviously exacerbated, if you will, the long-term trend toward the polarization of the Wisconsin labor market. But then what's happened since the recession is that all of the net job growth has occurred in Wisconsin, and we're not unique in this. There's a study in Ohio that sort of says the same thing, and there's a national study that shows more or less the same thing in the national labor market. All of the net growth since 2010 has been in the low-wage category, about 130,000 jobs created in the low-wage occupations. Continued losses in the middle-tier category, but what's been the big difference in the post-2010 period is that we've continued to lose jobs in the high-wage occupations. That wasn't the case earlier. Earlier, we had what economists call the polarization of the labor market, growth at the high end, growth at the low end, and a hollowing out, if you will, at the middle, which kind of corresponds to the level of inequality we're kind of seeing in American society. The post-2010 period, to borrow an expression from another economist, is not so much a polarization but a downward ramp in which the vast majority of the jobs that are created are effectively the low-wage jobs. So that's the big change. And I think, you know, to sort of answer your question about why, you know, we don't really know, and I think we need to do more research to find that out. But we do know that there are certain things that obviously in the long run have contributed to this trend, and perhaps they've simply exacerbated it in the post-2010 period.
Well, one story we sometimes hear when we talk about this topic is a decline in higher-paying manufacturing jobs. Those workers or the people who would have taken those jobs going into service sector jobs, and those manufacturing jobs being lost either to foreign competition, outsourcing, or various forms of mechanization, meaning the same factory requires a tenth the number of workers. Is that, do you think, part of the story behind this research?
Right. I mean, certainly automation is probably part of this. Offshoring is certainly part of the general trend. I mean, it's part of the general trend of the stagnation in real wages in Wisconsin that's occurred over not just since 2000, but even starting in the 1990s after trade agreements, which severely undermined in many cases the manufacturing sector in Wisconsin. There aren't too many, helpers and production workers dropped into the low-wage category. There aren't too many of those manufacturing jobs that have dropped into the low-wage category, but I think your point about the possibility of what we call occupational skidding, downward mobility of workers losing their manufacturing jobs, not being able to find equally paying jobs either in the service sector or other manufacturing jobs and then dropping down into the lower tier, certainly explains a part of this. And then the other part is that while a lot of those manufacturing jobs haven't become what we would call low-wage jobs, real wages in many of the sectors in Wisconsin manufacturing are dropping, which is sort of counterintuitive because we keep hearing about skills gap and the need for workers, and that would usually, if you think there's a labor shortage, would bid up wages. But in a wide range of manufacturing occupations that we looked at, real wages have been declining for the last two decades, and they continued to decline between 2010 and 2013. Welders, for example, which we hear about as being in shortage. So their real wages declined by 5% between 2010 and 2013. CNC machinists, same sort of thing. So I do think the decline in manufacturing is a piece of this, as well as obviously the rise of those low-paying service sector jobs, particularly in the personal care and home health services sector.
Mark, as part of your study, you cite, I think, state predictions that these low-income jobs are going to be the fastest-growing jobs. So looking at the impact of this, if this trend continues or even just plateaus where it is now, it seems like this has got to be somewhat bad news for Wisconsin's economy, tax revenues, a lot of things.
Yeah, I think it's a serious issue. I mean, I think it's one we clearly, need to grapple with and consider policy solutions. And I think there are a number of things that obviously, we need to look at. Labor market institutions. I mean, certainly the role of unions in the past in bolstering wages has been important. Those have obviously the ability of unions to influence wages has certainly come under siege in this state as it has across the country. The lagging value of the minimum wage. I mean, there's a notion of kind of raising the floor. If you raise the floor, then you can kind of push wages up throughout the, occupational structure. Human capital development, education, skills development is always going to be part of the equation to continue to enhance the ability of people to achieve upward mobility. But we really need to make major decisions in those areas because, as you mentioned, I pulled the data from the Department of Workforce Development's projections of which sectors are going to be growing, creating the most new jobs, or their predictions of which sector is going to be creating the most new jobs in the next decade or so, and they are overwhelmingly those low-wage jobs that have been spearheading the low-wage occupational growth of the previous decade. So unless we do something differently in the policy realm, we're likely to see these same economic results occurring in the next decade.
Mark, briefly, as we wrap up, we're in election season. We hear about raw jobs numbers a lot. But do you think lawmakers, candidates are talking about the issue you're raising here about the growth of low-income jobs?
Well, I don't think it's been the top job, the top issue on the economic policy discussion agenda during the campaign. It's come up a bit in the discussion of the minimum wage. Governor Walker obviously claiming the minimum wage doesn't serve a purpose, which I think given these data suggests that he may be wrong on that. Certainly, Mary Burke favors increasing the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. I would argue that's probably a good step, but it's certainly not enough, and there are other communities around the country. Chicago is now in the process, for example, Illinois, of raising over a period of time the minimum wage perhaps to $13 an hour. Seattle just passed a $15 an hour minimum wage. I think the issue certainly could be talked about a lot more. Hopefully after this election it will become an important policy issue for the legislature to take up, because we really do need to act on this issue.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Mark Levine, professor of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee, joining us to talk about his new report showing a rapid increase in low-wage jobs and not so much in the middle and upper-income jobs.
1 week from today, after over a year of campaigns and an estimated $4 billion in cash, the midterm elections will be over, and we'll be talking about the winners and the losers. It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
Some analysts are calling these the closest congressional elections in at least a decade. While Republicans remain the favorite for the Senate, a lot of races are still up in the air. We take a look at what the final stretch is going to look like for candidates around the country.
Also, while an unpopular president may be hurting Democrats, minimum wage hikes have become a winning theme for them. Here with us now is Paul Singer. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Veronica. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Well, would you agree with what seems to be a theme for analysts, that these are the tightest congressional races in at least a decade?
Sure, I guess. The House, as you recall, has flipped twice in the past 10 years. So, I don't know, 2006 was pretty exciting, and then 2010 was pretty exciting. So, of course, those are both big wave elections. I'm not sure this is going to be that big a wave, although, you know, it could be. It's still hard to tell.
Do you think this is an exciting season? The Atlantic had a big article about how this was the most boring season in a long time. Where do you come down on that?
Well, it depends what you do for a living. I mean, you know, this is our Super Bowl here in the political news business. So, we think it's kind of exciting. I think the thing that has got people at the moment sort of down on the election cycle is that we're showing in poll after poll after poll after poll that the general view of the public is malaise and frustration and unhappiness with the drift of America and with the tone of our conversation. So, you know, if you are a campaign junkie like some of us are, you think it's exciting to watch all these people race around and try and convince people to vote for them. But if you are a voter, you are probably tired of the nonstop barrage of negative ads. You're probably a little uncertain about the future of America at this point. You're a little concerned about all the headlines about Ebola and ISIS and other bad stuff. So it doesn't sound like any fun to you this year.
All right, well, let's get to the races, the stuff you're finding fun right now. There are two surprising trends we're looking at here in Georgia and West Virginia, just days away from these elections. What have you found there?
Yeah, it's really funny. They're almost mirror images of each other. We wrote a story that I think just went up online a few minutes ago about the West Virginia Senate race. This has never been competitive. Shelley Moore Capito is a congresswoman from West Virginia who is about to become the Republican senator from West Virginia. She'll be the first Republican senator since like the 1950s in West Virginia. And it's funny because, you know, in 2000, when Al Gore lost West Virginia as part of, you know, losing barely the presidential race, we all thought that was an anomaly, and West Virginia's been Democratic for years. Well, now, if this unfolds the way it looks like it's going to unfold, it's possible the last elected congressperson, the Democratic congressperson from West Virginia, will be Joe Manchin, the senator, and everybody else can be Republicans. I mean, the state has trended very heavily red over the past decade or so.
Real quickly, how come?
Well, partly it's because of coal, partly because the Democrats have been very heavily advocating for climate change rules and new restrictions on coal-burning power plants. That issue has resonated across across West Virginia, Kentucky, and other parts of coal country. There has been this message that Democrats are launching a war on coal. Republicans have mined that issue very much to their benefit. Georgia's the other way around. There was, you know, Georgia was a red state. We didn't even really look at it during the 2012 presidential campaigns. Now, all of a sudden, the governor, incumbent governor, is in trouble, a very close race against Jimmy Carter's grandson. The Senate race is an open seat for a Republican seat, and again, very close race between Michelle Nunn, the Democrat, and David Perdue, the Republican. We have two competitive races, and Georgia may be trending bluer.
Interesting. Well, 6 days or so until the elections. Can anything be accomplished in those 6 days, or is what we're seeing, you know, today pretty much going to solidify, and that's what we're going to see in the results?
It's hard to get any message out in the last 6 days. I mean, if you have not made the point yet, you're not going to make the point. And you know, basically, your opponent would have to shoot somebody to really break through and change the tenor of the discussion now in the last 6 days. Now, what does make a difference is, do you get your voters to the polls? Do you get to the doors? Do you knock on the doors? Do you get to the phone calls? Do you get the buses out to drag people over to the polls? That's what really makes a difference in these last closing days. It's execution now. It's technology now. It's not really message anymore.
Gotcha. Well, we're going to move on now, and you have a new information organizing tool that USA Today is using, and it looks at political action on Twitter. It looks at age, gender, location of people talking about a whole bunch of political topics. Can you describe it for us, and what struck you about it?
Yeah, this is an adventure, an experiment. We worked with Twitter. They have basically found a way to go through about a million tweets a day that cover political topics, and they're sorting them by topic and then breaking them down by gender, age, and location. We don't see individual tweets. We just see the bulk data on this stuff. And we're able to put it into a fun interactive graphic where you can scroll through it and sort of look at, you know, where are most of the tweets coming from on a certain topic. I mean, for instance, today, if you looked at the thing, you'd see that in the abortion, among abortion tweets, North Dakota has the highest, this big bubble in the middle of this. We show these things as basically various sized marbles. Big marble for North Dakota. How come? Well, it turns out that last night the North Dakota Supreme Court made a ruling on an abortion issue. So that then explains how come all this Twitter activity on abortion in North Dakota. It's really kind of cool.
Yeah, and one interesting thing, scrolling through the different issues, wages, abortion, Ebola, all of them really, is that it's guys doing most of the tweeting.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll find that by and large, although, again, if you look at that slide for the abortion one from today, and this thing updates daily, you look at the one from today on abortion, you'll see that it's not nearly as dominant with men, many more women than in other issue areas. But, yeah, Twitter is tends to be a male-dominated conversation. I can't tell you why that is. It just is. I don't know if it's because the platform tends to reward male behaviors of quick, punchy, aggressive commentary. I don't know. I'm making stuff up now. but yeah, that's there's a bunch of stuff that we're learning about this thing, and that's why I call it an experiment. We don't actually know what any of this tells us, but it's really interesting, and it's clearly clues to some things, that like the North Dakota example shows us.
Now, another thing that popped up was that the wage debate seems to be a winning message for Democrats, and this showed up prominently in Wisconsin. A lot of Wisconsin people tweeting about wages.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit and what it means for Wisconsin and for Democrats?
Sure. Well, this is, you know, and Wisconsin, of course, has had this long time, very strong union presence. Minimum wage issues is a big thing for the unions. And a big thing, I think, for a lot of working people. And, of course, for Democrats, it is a core issue of this election, is that the Republicans, they will say, are for the rich, and the Democrats are for the working guy, and the minimum wage increase is urgent and important. I suspect, and I'm not in Wisconsin, obviously, but I suspect this is an issue that Mary Burke is probably playing very hard against Scott Walker in the governor's race.
And Paul, just let me jump in there. Lots to talk about, but in our last 30 seconds, what are you doing to get ready for Election Day at USA Today?
Working all the time. we're designing stuff like this. We're doing online things. We're doing a whole series of internet stories. We've got staff deployed across the country. We're doing nothing but working and talking and reading politics 24/7.
And is it going to be an all-nighter?
Oh, yeah. The question is whether there's only going to be one.
Gotcha. Well, it'll be an exciting night. We'll hear about it afterwards. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica. Be well. Talk to you.
That was Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us every week at this time to talk about Congress, and he'll be with us from today and actually next week to cover the results of the midterms. We continue our series of candidate forums here on Central Time. Today's race is Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. For the last 35 years, the seat has belonged to Republican Tom Petri, but the longtime congressman announced earlier this year that he won't be seeking re-election. So for the first time in a long time, the seat is up for grabs, and three candidates have lined up to try and take it.
Democrat Mark Harris and Republican Glenn Grothman are the two major party candidates in the race. Mark Harris will join us later in the program. We extended invitations to Glenn Grothman to appear. He was unable to join us.
There's one other candidate in the race, and he joins us first. Gus Fahrendorf is the Libertarian candidate running for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District seat. Gus, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Gus, we're going to start with the question we're asking everybody. Why are you running? Why are you running in this case for Congress?
Why am I running? Just kind of personally have a calling for it. I don't know why. Literally, I woke up several months back in February, and I thought, it's just time to do something. So I filled out my form way before Petri said he was going to leave, and the other people jumped in. To answer the question, though, it's just the government doesn't seem to be doing its job. And it's personally, I believe the government's job is to kind of stay out of the way and get things done. I mean, the government's just too huge. It's too big to work. And so, in essence, I'm running to go repeal laws and slow down the process of passing new laws.
Well, tell us a little more about yourself. More specifically, can you fill us in on your past experience and how that might prepare you for a position in Congress?
Sure. It's kind of simple. Back in 93, I was a senior at UWM. And as a senior, I worked my way through college as a bartender and as a construction worker. So as a senior, my brain started going on getting jobs, and I put out resumes, and it was kind of tough back in 93. And then so what I did was I decided to actually just create my own construction company. So back in 1993, while a senior, I actually built and sold my first home. And I did that continually up until around 2008. And by then, the market was taking a tumble, of course, the housing market. However, by then, computers have became quite a hobby for me. So I was able to switch gears in about 2007 and 2008 and jump into computers. So I've been self-employed and an entrepreneur basically all of my adult life. So I've so that's kind of how it qualifies me. I'm just a self-starter, go do things, and obviously with building all those homes and then switching to computers, continually dealing with different types of clients all the time. So now I know how to work with everybody, I would like to think.
Yeah, so you would say that there's a translation there between your experience and helping to make laws in Congress.
I don't want to say helping to make laws. Again, my whole idea is to start repealing the laws. I think when you put law on top of law on top of law, and you have so many laws, all that really does is create gaps and loopholes. I think when you put 10 patches on one meaningful law that is on the bottom layer, it just creates strife and trouble. I mean, look at where we are socially and economically. That's all, law upon law upon law puts us $18 trillion in debt.
Now, across the board, from state Senate to the United States Congress, elections are boiling down to two large issues that people care a lot about, jobs and the economy. So we're going to focus on jobs first. What role do you think Congress should play in spurring job creation in Wisconsin and beyond?
I don't think it's the government's role to create jobs. I think it is the government's role to maintain a level playing field where all laws are relevant. Let it be safety laws and finance laws, things like that. However, the government seems to be picking winners and losers at times. So I think it's, in essence, to slowly peel back the regulations that are stifling. And personally, I believe that with all the regulations, some 50,000 pages of regulations, I think it's killing jobs. You know, as an entrepreneur, you know, all of my life, I know the loopholes you have to go through, and there's more and more. And that is why businesses that are just picking up root and going across borders, too many rules. They're going to where it's easier to play.
And there's also a general sense that the economy has improved some since the recession, but it's not maybe at the level that a lot of people would like it to be. How might you try to accelerate the pace of the economic recovery?
The same way. It's not the government's job to start investing financially, because then all it's doing is spending more. And if it spends more, it does one of two things. It taxes or it borrows, but it always goes into the debt. So I think repealing the laws, relaxing on the regulations, you're going to find jobs that will be created. And of course, jobs and the economy are almost one of the same.
Now, as a libertarian, you're clearly in support of less government. Can you talk about a few areas in the federal government that you think could benefit from some scaling back?
Oh, I think the EPA is a huge one. I think there are, it's insane. I mean, now they even have their own SWAT team. So does the FDA. They have their own SWAT team. Department of Education has its own SWAT team. This is just huge, exploding bureaucracies. And those kill. Bureaucracies kill. It doesn't, everything slows down too much and nothing can get up and running. So, I mean, yes, just take a look at the larger initialed entities and scale back on them and let people go. I mean, there's horror stories with the EPA of where, you know, a person will go out and get a building permit, start building their house. They'll have their house going and done. And then it comes time for a final inspection or for another inspection, and all of a sudden they decide to change it into a wetland after the ball started rolling. It's insane what happens to real people, and it's a shame, and it should be stopped.
Now, being a libertarian in Congress might mean not having a lot of allies from the Democratic and Republican parties. So with that in mind, how do you envision working with both parties and having a productive time in Congress?
Honestly, I think I would have lots of allies from both sides. I'm very fiscally responsible, so there'd be a lot of people in the Republican side that I'm sure would kick in. And then being more socially liberal, I'd be attracting some from the Democrat side as well. I think the two-party system, they're locked in a battle on all fronts. And to put a libertarian in the middle to kind of hold hands with everyone, I mean, it might be easier. I think it's time we try this. We've been here for generation and generation and generation of only the two-party system. And we're $18 trillion in debt. Why keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome? It's nonsensical.
We're going to move on and talk about the budget. Now, as always, there are ongoing concerns about growing national debt and the long-term stability of the country's financial situation. What do you think it's going to take to get the budget back on track?
The budget just it has to be gone through with a fine-tooth comb. I mean, as citizens, we can hear what the budget is, and they give us these large overview numbers. And some of them say, the cupboard is bare, we can't have any more cuts. And to me, that's ridiculous. I am sure the budget could be, a third of the budget could be cut out without even really going into the benefits people are getting. I'm just convinced of it. There has to be so many redundancies, they have to be purged. I mean, everything is tied together with it's just being too large. Do I have specifics? Not really. I'm sorry I can't offer very specifics of where I would cut out, but, you know, there are certain pork projects I would take out, I guess. You could start there. You know, the joke with the robo-squirrel costing $347,000 to see how a snake reacts to a robotic squirrel, and heaven knows there's thousands of those things, just these little pet projects that they can be shelved.
Would you consider raising taxes if it came to that?
You wouldn't have to raise taxes. I'm not a fan of raising taxes. I'm a huge fan of cutting spending. I don't think we have a tax problem. I think we have a spending problem.
Now, on another budget note, let's talk a little bit about Social Security and Medicare. There are question marks hovering over the future of these programs right now. Do you think they're in need of reform? And if so, what would that look like?
Medicaid and Medicare, I would like to have a task force on that. And when people get caught violating the laws of that and just forgery on what they are doing with Medicaid and Medicare, huge, stiff penalties. People go to jail. I think that is the most abused system that we have. And as far as Social Security, that's a problem. I am not for raising the limit on the age. I think the age is just fine. I would go in there, and what I would do is I would raise the cap on it. Right now it's at $118,500. I would raise that ceiling. How far I would raise it, I'm not quite sure, but I would raise it far enough to make it hurt. And by making it hurt, all the people in Congress, the House of Representatives and the senators, they will feel the pressure to fix Social Security by their larger donors. And also, by raising that ceiling, it would make it more solvent. Does that make sense? So it's doing one thing, but returning two ideas.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for now and come back and continue our conversation with congressional candidate Gus Fehrendorf. He's the Libertarian candidate running for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District seat, which is being vacated by retiring Congressman Tom Petri. If you've got a question for Gus or you're wondering where he stands on a particular issue, you can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, we're hosting a candidate forum with Gus Fehrendorf. He's the Libertarian candidate running for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District seat. If you've got a question for Gus or you want to hear his thoughts on an issue, you can give us a call right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And we're going to go to our callers now. We have John joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
I liked Ron Paul's message about bringing the American troops home, as well as like closing down the Federal Department of Education, things like that. And I wanted to ask your guest there if he agrees with me and agrees with Ron Paul that we should not get in between Russia and the Ukraine, we should not get in between ISIL and Iraq, we should not get in between China and Burma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We should bring the troops home, close down the Department of Education. They have no business in education. And also the prime point is, the question is that the Federal Reserve Bank, to the private bank, should we deprivatize it, nationalize it, or get rid of it?
All right, we're going to start with those foreign policy questions there, Gus. What do you think about, for instance, if we start with ISIS, what is your position? What would you advocate Congress do?
ISIS is a tough one. In a nutshell, I agree that we should really mind our own business. We really should pull back from all over the world, and we don't need 1,000 bases. They're over here because we're over there. It's a very sticky wicket now that we are in this situation, which we never should have gotten into. However, we are in it. ISIS seems to be, if all things are true that we hear in the media, ISIS seems to be probably one of the nastiest groups that have ever come up. I'm all for shutting down their supply lines and seeing what we can do to prevent them from coming to our shores. If that group gets too large and their sole mission on this world is to end the United States as we know it, something has to be done. And at the same time, we are not the world's police force. Okay? Does that make sense?
If pressed, would you advocate putting boots on the ground, American boots, to try to stop ISIS?
There's too many variables on that. I can't commit to either one. I would have to know really what's going on. I think boots on the ground could be avoided, which is would be my preference, of course. However, I'm not adverse to putting boots on the ground if something needs to happen. It depends on what they have. Do they all just all of a sudden we wake up one day and we know that they are nuclear armed? Do we know that? Then something's got to happen really fast. But boots on the ground is not always the best and first option.
Well, thank you, John, for your call. We're going to go next now to Dave in Oshkosh. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And also, thank you for having this candidate on here. It's refreshing to see a third-party candidate actually get a chance to speak. My question, and you briefly touched on it, was when we were talking about the economy earlier, I personally believe that it all starts with the Federal Reserve. Our current system that we have is designed to not work for us. And like I said, he briefly touched on it. I was wondering if he could just expand a little bit on what he believes we should do with that as far as revamping it, maybe going back to the gold standard, maybe abolishing it entirely. I don't know. What would he have to say about that?
All right. Thanks a lot, Dave. And Gus, what do you think about the Federal Reserve? What's your position there?
Hey, great question, Dave. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate that. The Federal Reserve, as Dave just touched on, it's a private country. It's a country, company. I'm sorry. It's a private entity. It is not owned by the federal government. Federal Reserve is a very misleading and purposeful name. Federal Reserve was started in 1910 by seven guys. These seven guys owned 25% of the world's wealth. They got together to do price fixing so they would not ever have to fight against each other for interest rates for lending out their wealth. In 1913, it became official. The Federal Reserve, its only goal is it's a cartel. And cartels, in the first place, are illegal. The Federal Reserve does nothing for us and for our money except create inflation. In 1971, when we got taken off the gold standard, if you were to see a pie chart, or not a pie chart, but a bar graph, and you could just look right across it, and you could see that thing do the old Al Gore hockey stick. Right at 1971, and then more so at 1975. Right off the charts. The Federal Reserve has to be abolished, period. We have to tie our money to something of real world value. Gold, silver, I'm not quite sure, but money has to be tied to something with a value. You can't just print money or crank numbers out on a computer and then have the government tell the world what it is worth and how much it should cost. It doesn't work that way. Fiat currencies have never lasted for very long, and ours, obviously, is on the way of the Weimar Republic. And I agree with Dave. The Federal Reserve, it's time for it to go.
Well, thank you for your call, Dave. And Gus, let's talk healthcare for a moment. Now, as it stands, the Affordable Care Act is law. Not everyone is happy with it. Do you think the law should stand as it is? Does it need changes, or would you suggest repealing?
I would like to get it repealed, have something in its place, but that's not going to happen. So let's assume that I do win this election and District 6 sees that I am the better candidate and decides to vote me in. We would have to work with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, as it is today. What I would like to see changed, the number one thing that would have to be changed in my mind, since appeal is not going to happen, is we have to open it up to more health providers. More and more insurers have to get on board. Okay, that is step one. Step two, we have to open up across state lines. Insurers have to be able to insure people in all 50 states so we create good competition. Also, the medical procedure has to be open to all 50 states, again, to get competition. Nothing brings us closer to perfection than competition. Look at it in the Olympics. Look at it in sports. Look at it with MP3 players. Competition is what brings perfection. That's all. Anything else?
That'll do it for that. And we're going to move on to another area that is on a lot of people's minds right now, and that's the Ebola outbreak. Now, dealing with the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa will be high up on the next Congress's to-do list. What should Congress be doing in order to halt the spread of the disease?
In America or across the world?
Well, it could be in America and policy that works in cooperation with other global health partners.
Well, right off the bat, you have to stop flights coming in from West Africa. It may be rude, but it's got to be done. The borders have to be shored up. I know a lot of people like porous borders. Even as a libertarian, it's a little odd, but I like very tight borders. We have immigration law. Going all the way back, we had Ellis Island, and we had Ellis Island for a reason. This was so individuals could be checked. They could be checked to see if they could handle themselves. They could check to see if they were mentally impaired. They could see if they'd have to have a sponsor. They'd have to be able to take care of themselves. And, of course, they'd come in and they'd be checked for disease. We, as a country, America eradicated many, many diseases, but they're all popping up on our shores again. And Ebola just happens to be one of them. There's more diseases that are going around than just Ebola. Ebola just happens to be the one on the news right now.
Are there other priorities that we haven't touched on yet that you would have as a member of Congress?
The one thing I would really like to do to bringing to Congress is to slow down the passage of bills. And it's a very easy process. The way they do bills now, they'll throw an omnibus bill on the table. Like you look at Obamacare, 2,600 pages. All right, and it's filled with TBAs, to be announced. And then they pass it, and that bill is already up to almost 12,000 pages. So I'm going to run through this really quick, and hopefully I'll remember them all. So you want to slow down the passage of laws, and you do this in several ways. One, there has to be truth in the title of what the bill is. Two, no more bills can be over 30 pages long. Every bill must sit for 30 days with online availability for all Americans to see, and that bill cannot be molested, nor can there be a rider put on it in those 30 days, or else the day starts over. The bill has to be one subject. Again, none of these omnibus bills. A lot of people are like, it's
and
not
Gus,
fair.
And Gus, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. If I could make one small mention.
I'm sorry we're exactly out of time, but we appreciate your time. Gus Fahrendorf is the Libertarian candidate running for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District seat.